Today at Reader's Corner, Stephen Levitsky, co-author of the new book, Tyranny of the Minority, Why American Democracy Reached the Breaking Point. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. America is moving toward a multiracial democracy in fits and starts, and the prospect of change has sparked an authoritarian backlash that threatens the foundations of our political system. Why is this happening here and not in other diversifying nations? And what can we do to save our democracy? In their new book, Tyranny of the Minority, Harvard professors Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Zablatt offer a coherent framework for understanding these volatile times. They draw on a wealth of examples from 1930s France to present-day Thailand to explain why and how political parties turn against democracy and how to reform our antiquated political institutions before it's too late. Stephen Levitsky is a professor of government at Harvard University. His research focuses on Latin America and the developing world. He is the author of Comparative Authoritarianism and previously joined us in 2019 to talk about his book, How Democracies Die, an instant New York Times bestseller, again, co-written with Daniel Zablatt. Stephen Levitsky, welcome back to Reader's Corner.
Thanks for having me back, Bob.
Well, your book is certainly the most important book I've read among those that have been written in the last few years about the current state of our democracy and what it will take to resuscitate it. And I wanted to say that up front so our listeners understand that we're going to do everything we can to cover all this material. But buying the book and sitting down and learning about American government, the challenges it currently faces, and most importantly, how to do something about it, to me is a most important requirement. I was particularly impressed, by the way, with how you weave historical examples into your argument that not only strengthen the argument, but also share some little-known moments in history that readers may have missed in their history classes. And by the way, that includes me. I wasn't up on the French example, for example. But we'll get to that in a moment. Let me just kick this off. America is not quite the multiracial democracy, as I indicated in the intro. How does that challenge the framework and the argument of your book?
That we're not quite a multiracial democracy?
Yes.
It depends on standard for multiracial democracy. I think the most important point for our book is the extraordinary movement that this country has made over the last 50 years, since the mid-1960s until today, toward multiracial democracy. I think people often sort of forget just how far we have come. We can argue about whether we've sort of crossed the line towards a truly multiracial democracy or not. I think we're not quite there because it's pretty clear that our criminal justice system does not treat all Americans equally. The rate of harassment and arrest and the convictions for African American men continue to be different from those of white Americans. Access to the vote, and ease of registering and voting continues to be different for Latinos and for African Americans than it is for whites. So even though we've made extraordinary progress towards racial equality in the last 50 years, my own view is that we're not quite there. Mm-hmm. But I think what is driving the crisis that we describe in the book is in fact the progress that we've made. Even if we're not quite at multiracial democracy, the changes of the last 50 years, the fact that we've become a much more diverse society, first of all, and secondly, a much more racially equal society. The fact that we have not destroyed, but challenged racial hierarchies that have been in place for 200 years is a big part of the crisis that we're facing right now. And that the challenging of long established racial hierarchies has generated a pretty extreme anti-democratic reaction.
Mm. And what's so interesting about the way you treat this in your book is, and I'm going to go a little bit out of order of your book and take us into the middle of it, where you talk about North Carolina. There was a time when we had a very inclusive democracy working in North Carolina, especially Wilmington, which was the state's largest city in the latter part of the 19th century. Just give us a thumbnail sketch of how that worked then.
Well, for a brief period in the aftermath of the Civil War, the United States experimented. This was our first experiment with multiracial democracy. The Reconstruction reforms, Reconstruction amendments, 13th, 14th, and 15th amendments, the presence of federal troops in the U.S. South, and a series of laws made possible in the late 1860s and the very early 1870s, the rapid enfranchisement of African American men. So it was not a fully democratic system because women didn't have the right to vote. But African American men were rapidly enfranchised and were able to vote freely in elections particularly in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War. Mm-hmm. And there were efforts starting in the 1870s to roll back the Reconstruction reforms. But African Americans continued in different parts of the South to bravely go out and register and vote throughout the late 19th century. And in some places, particularly the thriving city of Wilmington, which was majority Black, you got the emergence of a truly multiracial democracy, or pretty close to it. There was an alliance between the Republican Party, which was at the time the party that championed civil rights, and populists who were emerging in the aftermath of economic crises in the late 19th century, that brought to power what was in effect a multiracial coalition in different parts of North Carolina, but particularly in Wilmington. So you had a number of African American elected to Congress, and a number of African Americans in elected and appointed positions for a brief period of time in the late 19th century.
And then, of course, it wasn't when Black turnout plummeted from 61% to 2%. And I guess that's when the federal government pretty much gave up on enforcing anything in the South. Is that correct?
Right. Reconstruction required was resisted. It was resisted violently by a number of, but primarily by Southern whites represented by the Democratic Party, resisted in ways that we often don't think about here in the United States. There was a large scale terrorism in the U.S. South in the 1870s. Illegal seizures of power. Wilmington itself suffered a coup, an armed uprising that literally overthrew the elected mayor and administration, and replaced it through an armed putsch. There were stolen elections. There were cases in which African Americans were forced away from the polls at gunpoint. And so it was through a violent seizure of power that Reconstruction was rolled back. It was not an accident. It wasn't lack of interest that led African American turnout to decline from 61% in 1880 to around 2% in the early 20th century. It was, first of all, violence, and secondly, a series of laws that were passed, particularly in the 1880s and 1890s, that made it difficult, if not impossible, for the vast majority of African Americans to vote. So poll taxes, residency requirements, literacy requirements that allowed local officials to systematically keep African Americans from voting. Mm-hmm. And so our first experiment with multiracial democracy was followed by our first real experiment with authoritarianism. The U.S. South was under single-party authoritarian rule for nearly a century, from the late 19th century all the way until the Civil Rights reforms of the 1960s.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Stephen Levitsky, co-author of the new book, Tyranny of the Minority, Why American Democracy Reached the Breaking Point. So the issue here in your book is how we as Americans deal with the transfer of power from one party or coalition to another. Obviously, during that very bright period in the 19th century, it was dealt with very well, apparently, with the election of so many Black office holders. Let's move forward to today. How does America stand apart from other Western democracies when it comes to boosting the electoral fortunes of far-right parties and movements?
the electoral fortunes of far-right parties and movements. This is something that's pretty common, pretty similar across Western democracies. If you look at Western Europe, you find that somewhere between 15 and 30%, 20 to 30% of the electorate is attracted to or now often voting for what we might call far-right political parties, parties that stand for something pretty similar to what MAGA stands for in the United States, what Trumpism stands for. It's nowhere a majority, but it's a pretty solid quarter and maybe even close to a third of the country. That's true in France and Germany and Sweden and the UK and the United States. What's different, and this has to do with our country's institutions, is that in other democracies, the MAGA-like forces have not been able to govern unilaterally and have not assaulted democratic institutions. So either MAGA forces have remained in MAGA-like forces, far-right forces have either remained in opposition, like in Germany and France, or they have been junior partners in coalitions, like in Scandinavia and Austria, or they've been the leading partner in Italy, but they share power with other political parties. So no other country, at least in Western Europe, does a far-right party govern the country on its own. Only in the United States, where arguably with Trump, the Republican Party transformed from a traditional center-right party like, say, the conservatives in Britain into something much more like a far-right party under Trump. Only here, between 2016 and 2020, did an extreme right party govern the country on its own. Mm-hmm. So the threat has been more severe so far in the United States than in Europe. And one of the outcomes of that is that the United States has suffered much greater democratic decline than any other established rich democracy. If you look at Germany, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, France, Scandinavia, UK, Spain, Italy, none of those countries have experienced democratic backsliding in the last 6 or 7 years. The United States, democracy hasn't collapsed. It's obviously survived, but every major index, global democracy index out there, including the most credible, show a decline in the level of democracy in the United States since 2016. Just to take one example, Freedom House, a U.S.-based NGO that measures democracies worldwide and which gives each country a score from a low of 0 to a high of 100 every year. The United States a decade ago had a score of 92, or low 90s, which put us right on par with Canada and Germany and the UK and Japan. Today it has a score of 83, which puts us in a tie with Romania and Panama and puts us below Argentina. Now, that may seem shocking to many Americans, but when you have widespread efforts to restrict access to the ballot, when you have violent threats against election officials and against elected officials and prosecutors, when you have an effort by the incumbent president of the United States to overturn the results of an election, you fall to a point where you were considered by Freedom House to be less democratic than Argentina.
Well, the date that comes to mind for anybody listening is January 6, 2021. What may not come to mind is France's date of February 6, 1934. What could we learn from that experience?
Well, that date was new to me, too. As you noted in the intro, Bob, I studied Latin America for – that's my day job anyway. My co-author, right. Daniel, is a Europeanist. He studies – Europe, and in particular, has studied the crisis and breakdown of democracies in Europe in the 1920s and 30s. And so not long after January 6th, Daniel pointed out to me that there were real parallels to what happened on February 6th, 1934 in France, where the parliament was electing a new prime minister and a group of far-right militia types or far-right activists tried to seize the parliament, and with the complicity of some of the right-wing parliamentarians sitting inside the building, they failed. But there was a violent clash with the police. There were several deaths. And there was an effort to investigate and bring to justice those who were behind this insurrection, an effort to storm the parliament. And it was essentially gutted by mainstream conservatives. And eventually many of those behind the insurrection, first of all, they were protected and eventually were embraced and even lionized by conservatives in France. And we argue that the failure to hold to account those who were behind a violent assault on democratic institutions contributed to eventually the weakening of French democracy. And many of those who were involved in the plot or the uprising in 1934 went on to join the Vichy government after the Nazis invaded. So things did not end well.
I guess the model for building an autocracy today is Viktor Orban in Hungary. What tools did he use that I think you and Daniel Ziblatt would argue are the tools autocrats use across the board, no matter what country it is? If you want to take power, here's how you do it.
Yeah, Orban is certainly the model. He's been more successful, I think, probably than anyone else on earth, in part because he's done it without spilling a drop of blood and really without arresting any of his opponents. So he's done it in a virtually, in a sense, in a legally impeccable way. But nevertheless, he has tilted the playing field against the opposition. You cannot have a democracy when opposition parties don't have fair access to the media, don't have fair access to resources, to campaign resources, and when both the election authorities and the legal authorities are packed and biased towards the government. And that is what Orban was able to do. So going back to our first book, How Democracies Die, it's rare these days that you see democracies die by an old-fashioned military coup. It's rare that generals just topple the an elected leader and seize power and do away with democratic institutions. It happens sometimes. It happened in Egypt not too long ago, a decade ago, but it doesn't happen very often. Much more often, you get an Orban-like phenomenon where an elected leader then uses the very institutions of democracy to undermine democracy, does so by first, almost invariably, first and foremost, hacking the courts, getting control of the judicial branch over the prosecutor's office, and then using the judicial branch, using law enforcement and the law to protect the government from investigation or any kind of accountability, and then to use the law gradually as a weapon to punish opponents. And Orban has done that brilliantly. He had the good fortune, thanks to electoral institutions and a scandal involving his opponents, to in 2010 to win a supermajority, to win a two-thirds majority in parliament. So his party was able to single-handedly reform the constitution. And it did so very quickly, before anybody knew really what was happening, in ways that enabled him to pack the top of the judicial branch and to change the media structure in ways that allowed him to increasingly pack both the public and the private media with allies. And now the vast bulk of Hungarian media is controlled by his allies, and the judicial branch is controlled by Orban's allies. So he doesn't lock up his opponents, but he's been able to tilt the playing field in ways that make it very hard for the opposition to win. And the frightening thing about Orban, not only is how successful he's been, but he's become a model. Little Hungary has become a model for the authoritarian far right elsewhere in the world, including the United States. I mean, there was a time when I was younger when Republicans thought that the United States was the model for the world, that other countries ought to emulate American democracy and American leadership. But Republicans have transformed so much that they now view Viktor Orban and a few of them, Vladimir Putin, but more commonly, they hold up Viktor Orban, not the United States, but Orban's Hungary as the model to follow.
This is Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Stephen Levitsky, co-author of Tyranny of the Minority, Why American Democracy Reached the Breaking Point. The book offers important context for our volatile times and a framework for how to protect our democracy from an authoritarian backlash. Well, if Americans are going to gauge the extent to which their country follows the same path as Orbán's Hungary, it's going to need some kind of guidelines, some kind of guidelines that help us along here. And you give us the Republican Accountability Project as an example of how we can gauge the commitment to democracy. I think there were six requirements of office holders. You don't need to give all six if you don't want, but if you could just give our listeners some idea of how this works. And finally, how does the Republican Party of today stand up to these?
Sure. Let me use a slightly simpler metric, but I'll get to the Republican Accountability Project, which I think was a very, very useful project. We argue that a political party that is committed to democracy, what the great political scientist Juan Linz called a loyal Democrat — this is small d Democrat, not the Democratic Party, but a party that's committed to democracy — has to do three really basic things. First of all, it needs to accept the results of elections unambiguously, always, win or lose, pretty simple. That's sort of the cardinal rule of democracy. Secondly, party has to unambiguously reject the use of political violence. And third, the party needs to break all ties with anti-democratic extremist forces. All that's pretty simple, and most U.S. parties have done those things throughout history. But we argue that particularly since 2020, since the November 2020 election, the bulk of the Republican Party leadership falls down on all three of those things. Not only did Donald Trump become the first sitting U.S. president not to accept the results of an election, actually to try to overturn the results of an election, but the bulk of the Republican Party, especially in Congress, went along with that. And this is where the Republican Accountability Project survey was so useful. They evaluated the public statements of every sitting Republican member of Congress in 2020, in early 2021, all of the Republican House members and all Republican senators. And they asked the simple question of, did the public statements of this congressperson call into question the legitimacy of the election? Did they stand up and say, well, Joe Biden won, that stinks, but we accept it and we look forward to working with him, as small d Democrats should? Or did they somehow raise doubts about the results of the election? And it turns out that more than 80% of Republican House and Senate members nationally, in their public statements, raised doubts about the legitimacy of the 2020 election. So 80%, I believe it was 85%, I don't have the data in front of me, of House members did not check off that first box of unambiguously accepting the results of elections. And this is a dramatic, dramatic change. It's the first time in modern U.S. history, in any of our lifetimes, that anything like this has happened. And it's really dangerous. We also find that most Republican leaders did, in fact, denounce the January 6th uprising. They were much better about that than they were the election. But some of them said it was overstated. Some of them, kind of like the right in France, defended the participants in the uprising. Donald Trump himself, the leader of the Republican Party, has defended and said he will and has suggested that he will pardon those who participated in the uprising. Republicans in the House and Senate refused to vote for an independent commission to investigate January 6th. And of course, even though leaders like Mitch McConnell have said publicly that Donald Trump is responsible for the January 6th uprising, Republican leaders, almost to a person at this point, say they will back him for president in 2024. So a guy who attempted to overturn the results of an election and who instigated a violent insurrection at the Capitol, the vast bulk of Republican leaders say they will endorse for 2024. So to me, that's a violation of the second and third requirements for Democratic behavior. You do not have an unambiguous rejection of violence, and you have a refusal to break with extremist anti-democratic forces. So only recently, a party that has been around competing peacefully in elections for 150 years has now gone off the rails, has walked away from its commitment to democratic rules of the game. And that is incredibly dangerous for our democracy. A democracy cannot survive, at least not for very long, if one of two major parties is not committed to playing by democratic rules.
And as you say, those democratic rules clearly would contain voting rights. And it takes us to the one Supreme Court decision I'll mention in this interview, and that is Shelby County versus Holder. It's a 2014 Supreme Court decision that significantly weakened the Voting Rights Act of 1965. That's almost the rationale for your book, Tyranny of the Minority. Help us understand what's going on here and how the John R. Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, which was intended to correct the work of the Shelby County case, failed.
Well, the Supreme Court is an example of, and we can get into this in more detail, but the United States is an unusually counter-majoritarian democracy in that we have a whole set of institutions that allow partisan minorities to systematically and often permanently thwart the will of majority. Now, counter-majoritarian institutions, this is important, are essential to democracy. Democracy is not simply majority rule. A modern democracy absolutely must protect minorities in a couple of important senses. First of all, it must protect individual civil rights, the freedom of conscience, freedom of speech, of assembly, association, freedom to vote, and it must protect. So no majority should be able to violate those basic civil rights. That's why you need the Bill of Rights. That's why you need an independent judiciary. That's why you need a Supreme Court. The rules of the political game also need to be protected from majorities. It should not be the case, it cannot be the case in a democracy that a single party can unilaterally change the political rules of the game in ways that weaken opposition. That's what happened in Hungary. It's what happened in Venezuela under Hugo Chavez. It's what almost happened in Israel. It looks like that's going to be blocked. So it's got to be hard to change the Constitution. So some counter-majoritarian institutions, the Bill of Rights, the difficulty changing the Constitution, federalism, and a powerful Supreme Court are essential to democracy. But as we lay out in the book, U.S. goes way overboard in terms of excessively counter-majoritarian institutions. And one of those is the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, we are now the only established democracy in which Supreme Court justices have truly lifetime tenure on the court. Every other established democracy in the world has either a retirement age, often 70 or 75, or term limits, 12, 18 years, 15 years on the court. The United States has neither. So we have a Supreme Court in which justices appointed in one generation can thwart majorities generations down the road. And so the Supreme Court ruling of Shelby County ruling was a counter-majoritarian move. Most Americans support, according to polls consistently, most Americans, in fact, even most Republicans in Congress supported the Voting Rights Act, support broad access to the vote. And yet this ruling enabled local officials to chip away at voting access. You mentioned the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. That's a piece of legislation that would have reestablished the Voting Rights Act and included a whole set of measures that would make it easier for people to register and vote. Most Americans, in fact, large majorities of Americans in polls are supportive of government efforts to make it easier for people to vote. The John Lewis Voting Rights Act passed the House. It had a majority in the Senate. But it failed due to filibuster, another excessively counter-majoritarian institution.
Stephen Levitsky, thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner. The book, Tyranny of the Minority, It is such an important book about the current state of American democracy and how to resuscitate it that I asked Professor Levitsky to continue our conversation. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.